Program, we'll be talking with Christopher Hallowell. He teaches English and journalism at City University of New York and has done a lot of writing about the environment and the culture of the Gulf Coast along Louisiana and Mississippi. We'll be talking about a book that he wrote. It was actually published a couple of years ago, but now is certainly relevant, a book titled Holding Back the Sea. The subtitle is The Struggle on the Gulf Coast to Save America, and it talks about the loss of wetlands along the Gulf Coast, how much has been lost over the past a couple of hundred years probably, and it is very significant, and talks about the impact on the environment and on the culture of the people who live on the coast. And certainly there is a connection to the kind of damage that the coast and the city of New Orleans sustained as a result of Hurricane Katrina. So that is what we'll be doing in the second part of Focus 580 this morning. And I am told we have now gotten set up and are all connected with our guest for this first part of Focus 580. And we are pleased to be talking this morning, as I say, with Dr. Howard Markle. He is a physician. He's also an historian of medicine and is interested in medical education. And we'll be talking in this part of the show about how it is that over the last century or so, people in the public health field in this country have dealt with outbreaks of infectious disease. Now, just a month ago, in the early part of November, President Bush announced that he would be asking Congress for $7.1 billion to prepare the nation for the possibility of an outbreak of deadly flu. He made his announcement in speech at the National Institutes of Health. He said a flu pandemic would have global consequences, so no nation can afford to ignore the threat, and every nation has responsibilities to detect and stop its spread. He said that most of the money would be spent on research and also on establishing a stockpile of vaccines and antiviral drugs. Just a month before that, though, in the early part of October, at a press conference at the White House, President Bush asked that the Congress give him the power to order a military-enforced quarantine in the event of an avian influenza breakout. And this morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of the quarantine in American society and how public health officials have used that as a tool to try to spread or try to limit the spread of infectious disease. This is something that our guest is very interested in. He's authored a number of books in two major areas. He's written quite a lot about children's health, as he is a professor of pediatrics. He's also written about epidemics and public health in the United States during the 20th century. And just to mention one of the titles that covers this subject that I've been looking at and you might look at if you're interested in the subject, it's a book titled When Germs Travel, Six Major Epidemics That Have Invaded America Since 1900 and the Fears They Have Unleashed. This book is published by Pantheon, and it came out just this past spring. Our guest, Howard Markle, is a physician. He's professor of the history of medicine, professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases, professor of history, professor of health management and policy, professor of psychiatry, and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. And in addition to the books that he's written and also scientific articles, he's a contributing writer for the New York Times, and his pieces have appeared in a lot of other places as well, including Harper's and The Atlantic and The New Republic and The Wall Street Journal and others. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments from people listening are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief as possible, so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But anybody who would like to call is welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455, or WILL, that's for folks here in and around Champaign-Urbana, and anywhere around Illinois and Indiana, even if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Dr. Merkel, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good.
Thanks.
Good.
Well, thanks for talking with us. I was interested in taking a look at the book, this one that I mentioned, that you explained that some of your interest, at least, in trying to explore this whole subject of quarantine goes back to when you were working with AIDS patients back in the 80s. And apparently many of them would say to you, do you think that because of my AIDS, I'm going to be quarantined? And that started you thinking, well, that's an interesting question. The fact that you were asked over and over again, and that got you thinking generally about the idea of quarantine.
Yeah, those questions, basically the result of pursuing the answers to those questions, occupied the next 15 years of my life. You know, when you're a doctor, you don't hear the same questions all the time. Well, there are certain questions you hear a lot. You know, will this hurt, or how do I take this pill? But you don't hear the same broad social questions all the time. And this was the late 1980s, early 1990s. I was had finished my pediatrics training at Johns Hopkins and was working on a PhD in the history of medicine at the time, so frantically searching for something to write about, which is what you do when you get a PhD. And I was seeing patients who had HIV or AIDS. It was early enough in the epidemic where there were a lot of doctors who just refused to treat people with HIV. We forget about that, but in the first decade of the epidemic, even in the United States, it's still going on in other parts of the world, people were very stigmatized and shunned because of this terrible disease. And so I would get questions from patients, you know, doc, do you think I'll be quarantined because I have AIDS? And my first response was, well, no, that's not the appropriate use of quarantine, because as we know, and as we knew then, that HIV was primarily sexually transmitted, but you can also get it from blood, you know, blood products or sharing needles or things like that, and rarely maternal fetal transmission. And so that didn't seem to me to be the type of disease that quarantine would work for. But because I kept hearing about it, I started thinking about the broader ramifications of quarantine, which it's very much a social mechanism. You are saying, you and you, we're isolating you from society at large. We're keeping you away because you're suspected of being ill. Now, you have to remember, quarantine in 21st century parlance is a little bit different than isolation. Quarantine means we separate those who we suspect of being ill. Isolation is we separate those who we know or we've diagnosed as being ill with a contagious disease. But as I thought about the people who were asking me these questions, mainly young gay men and intravenous drug users, it suddenly struck me, well, these are people who have been stigmatized by society at large on many levels. And so it's not surprising that they would worry that what will happen if I have a so-called contagious disease and I am part of a so-called undesirable social group. And the short answer that I've studied over the last 15 years is often bad stuff.
Yeah.
Is that combination of a particular minority group or a so-called socially undesirable group and a contagious disease often leads to very harsh and biased and sometimes racist public health policies, which we're getting better at every day of trying to eliminate.
Well, when you think back, though, to what physicians and public health people at this time had to offer, what was in their bag of tools to deal with infectious disease, this predates antibiotics and the kind of medical treatment, antiviral drugs and the kind of things that we have now. So it seems on the one hand that they really didn't have much else to offer, and even if they had an imperfect understanding of the mechanisms of disease transmission, they knew enough that it was passed from one person to the next. So in on the face of it, it would make sense for them to say, there's not very much we can do to control the spread of the disease except try and do what we can to limit transmission from person to person. And it seemed the idea of a quarantine on that basis seems fairly reasonable.
Yeah, and for specific diseases, it still is. You know, we're still talking about quarantine now for influenza, and we talked about it and actually enacted it for SARS a few years ago. And you're right. I mean, quarantine dates back far longer than antibiotics. In fact, there's evidence in antiquity in the ancient Greek texts of something like quarantine, and certainly evidence in the Bible. But the term quarantine is an Italian word, quarantinaria, or quarante giorno, which means 40 days. And it was coined in 1373 when there was a terrible plague epidemic raging throughout Europe. It was the Black Plague, killed about a third of Europe's population. And Venice, which was a major port, ordered a 40-day quarantine law. No boats could come in or out. No foreign visitors could come in or out. It was they locked the gates of the city. 40 days was thought to be the time that a plague epidemic would burn itself out, and that's probably true. But as the years have gone on, we fine-tuned quarantine depending on the natural history of the infection we're trying to keep out. So influenza, for example, has an incubation period of roughly 24 to 3 or 4 days. So if you could isolate a suspect for, say, 4 or 5 days, you'd be, and they did not develop influenza, you'd be pretty safe in giving them medical clearance. The other thing about quarantine is that we've learned it needs to be applied to rather specific types of diseases. So something that's very casually transmitted, sounds like flu, coughing, sneezing, breathing, that might work better than, say, something that is not casually transmitted, such as AIDS. Now, you have to be doing some very specific things to put yourself at risk to contract HIV. And so we have found that behavioral education, you know, issues like safer sex and so on, not sharing needles, that is a better way to go than the quarantine. But then there's that middle category that you just alluded to. What about a disease that's newly emerging that you never have seen before? You know it's communicable, but you don't know how. And that's where you don't want to take any chances. And that's the lot of the quarantine officer, you know, the guy who has to order a quarantine. If he's too early or he jumps the gun or he's mistaken, everyone complains. You know, you shut off our business, we've lost money, you've inconvenienced us, and so on and so forth. If he's too late and it does spread, people die. So it's a very difficult job, and hitting that so-called sweet spot that we used to talk about in baseball, that's very tough for a quarantine or public health officer to achieve.
Our guest, let me just introduce again our guest for this hour of the show, Dr. Howard Markle. He's a physician and also historian of medicine. He's professor of the history of medicine. He's also professor of pediatrics, communicable diseases at the University of Michigan, and has written a number of books, both on the subject of children's health, as he is a pediatrician, also on taking a look at epidemics and public health in the United States during the 20th century. And that's what we're talking about here this morning, a little bit about particularly the idea of quarantine and how that was applied and how, in many cases, it didn't work very well. And given now that there is even greater mobility of people, it seems the idea of quarantine makes even less sense than it did. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, perhaps you can tell a story from the book that not only shows the how quarantine can be an imperfect means, but also this connection between foreigners and contagion. And since you mentioned the fact that the term comes from an outbreak of bubonic plague, maybe you could talk a little bit about the outbreak of plague that occurred in San Francisco's Chinatown in 1900.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories. And you know, the first real epidemic that involved foreigners in the United States in the 20th century. You would think if you're going to pick a place, it would be New York City, because 75% of all the immigrants were coming through Ellis Island, and there were millions per year. You know, between 1890 and 1924, some 24 million newcomers came to American shores. Many of them are grandparents. And if you ask a room of people, 66% of them, their parents or their grandparents came from another country. But anyway, it really wasn't there. It was in San Francisco, and it was in 1900. And they discovered a case of bubonic plague, the dreaded Black Plague, in a Chinese man named Chick Jin. He was an itinerant wood and scrap collector that he sold to other people who needed wood either for fuel or for building projects. He had lived in the United States, I might add, for 18 years. And he was actually bedding down in a flop house that night. It was March of 1900, and he was groaning and moaning and in terrible pain, and he seemed to be sweating. And these beds were all, you know, they were cots, were cheek by jowl next to each other. And the man next to him noticed that something was wrong, and he went to get the hotel clerk. By the time they had come back, of course, Chick Jin was dead, and when they took down the blankets, they found all these large lesions, these baseball-sized lesions under his armpits and his groin, which are called buboes. That's where bubonic plague comes from. Bubo means a large mass. And that's something what the germ, a bubonic plague, a germ called Yersinia pestis, does. It clogs up our lymph nodes to a point that they grow and swell and become hard and quite painful. And, of course, the germ does a lot of other things to really destroy a human being and kill him or her quite rapidly. And so because this man was Chinese and because there was a great deal of prejudice against Chinese citizens back then, even though there were a lot of immigrants, Chinese immigrants were less than 1% of that 24 million people who came during that period, the public health officials of San Francisco declared a quarantine on Chinatown, the Chinese neighborhood of San Francisco. There was a very jagged jigsaw kind of a line, a borderline around the blocks of Chinatown. If you were a white, native-born American person living across the street from Chinese people or even next to them, you were not part of the quarantine, but if you were Chinese, you were. And there was literally a cordon sanitaire. There were ropes, there were lines, there were policemen, armed policemen, and of course that instilled a great deal of panic, distrust, and anger among the Chinese citizens. Because after all, one of the things that was well known, even by 1900, was that not only do germs travel, and which is why I call my book When Germs Travel, but also they're rather egalitarian. They don't really care who they attack. They're looking for a warm body. They don't care if your skin is one color or another, or your eyes look one way or the other. They're just looking for a warm human body to inhabit. And what actually happened was a lot of chaos, a lot of running away. Some Chinese people would not submit to examinations by public health officers and fled, which, by the way, could help spread the disease, and it did. And finally, the very organized Chinese citizens took the public health department of San Francisco to court and fought them on a 14th Amendment clause of equal due process under the law. And they actually won their case, and the quarantine was dismantled.
So now what sort of lessons does one draw from this, particularly, is there anything that you can take from this story and apply it to now, yeah, where we are now? And for example, if we're talking about something like the recent concerns over SARS, or now current concerns that the possibility that if we get an avian flu virus that mutates to the point where it could be easily spread, right, from person to person, right, then obviously we're gonna have a serious situation.
Right. Well, there's so many lessons. One is that scapegoating individual social groups is always a bad idea, and that if that so-called scapegoated group feels it's being imposed upon in a way that's not fair or needed, they often rebel. And there's a variety of ways they can rebel, from running away and hiding and spreading the disease to riots. Another chapter in my book talks about a typhus epidemic on the Texas-Mexico border, and some of those people simply engaged in a riot, to legal machinations, to all sorts of things. So you need to have a fair and unbiased quarantine process, and you need to be explaining that to people as much as you can. And it doesn't just end when you put the sign on the door. You have to have communication with those who are under quarantine. You have to have proper food and water, medical care, and even entertainment. But the other thing, too, that we learn time and again throughout the history of quarantine is that it doesn't work very well. There was a great physician in the 19th century and early 20th century, William Henry Welch, who was one of the founders of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And he was giving a speech about the value or lack thereof of quarantine during a cholera epidemic in 1892. And he said, quarantine is like a big ship on stormy waters, on a stormy ocean. No matter how hard you try to plug the holes of this leaky ship, water still manages to get in. And that's the thing about quarantine. It's an imperfect method at best, because people break the quarantine or ignore it or don't listen to you to begin with, and on and on and on. So by the time you've gotten to quarantine orders, it's fairly late in the epidemic. You're many, many steps behind it, and to use that old cliche, the cow has gotten out of the barn door. So that's why preventive methods, if you look at the history of epidemics across time, those that prepare before the crisis always do better than those that react to it.
Let's talk with someone who is listening this morning. We have a caller in Kankakee on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Dr. Markle, your caller has many questions. If he's prepared to focus 580 and his other callers, he'll only ask three, and then if he has a chance, he'll perhaps call again with more. One, would you discuss the early history of medicine, that is, Hippocrates, et cetera, discuss Celsus, Paracelsus, et cetera? Two, would you discuss the history of modern alternative, complementary, and integrative medicine, that is, Dr. Andrew Weil, et cetera? And three, would you discuss the statesmanship and the medical advisability of any proposed militarily enforced vaccination or quarantine programs in the United States? Thank you.
All right.
Boy, those are three shows in and of
themselves. Yes, I was thinking any one of those things we could certainly talk an hour about. I don't know if you might like to, you can handle the question however you want, but certainly the third question seems to apply most directly to what it is we've here been talking about.
Well, let's go to the third question about enforced, whether it's militarily or legal. Police enforce either quarantine or vaccination. And that comes up, I talk about that in my book, When Germs Travel. Some of the greatest Donnybrooks, both in the Chinese plague epidemic in 1900, as well as in the typhus epidemic of 1915 in Texas, had to do with enforced vaccinations, enforced disinfections, and so on. And people didn't seem to like that, especially back then when these vaccines were not nearly as good or efficacious as they are today. We find, by the way, the public health department, say in Urbana, Champaign-Urbana, or Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I live, or New York, does have supreme police powers in the event of an epidemic crisis. These laws have been on the books forever, basically. Long before the United States was founded, in European nations they were on the books. And so one of my favorite examples of this is that in 1893, the New York City contagious disease inspector was called before Congress to testify on his powers. He said, you know, I have such power that I could make the Capitol building a quarantine hospital tomorrow if I so designated it. And they do have this power on the books. The problem is, as you know, is that the first word in public health is public. And if the public gets mad or is afraid or thinks you're doing things that you shouldn't be doing, then they can rebel. And so you have to ask whenever you're designing a public health approach, is my approach helping matters or worsening matters? So if it is an approach that makes people run away or ignore what you're doing, then you have to revise that. What we're learning more and more as the 20th century progressed and now as the 21st century is unfolding is that there are many ways of encouraging people to cooperate than, you know, the strong arm of the law. But don't think that doesn't exist. And in the case of a contagious crisis, it could be rolled out again. I would hope that everybody who can get access to a flu vaccine, particularly those who need it, get it. We have to beg people every year to get flu vaccines. I would also hope that people would voluntarily, during a regular flu epidemic, we have not had an avian flu human-to-human epidemic, thank goodness, but even during a regular flu epidemic, you have a cold, be polite, don't go to work. You know, that's a problem. You are going to infect other people with something like that. But in the case of, you know, a true pandemic, as the ones that many health officials and health experts have been predicting and worrying about and actually losing significant sleep over, that's a different ball of wax entirely. And I think if that did happen, we would see some type of, whether it's called martial law, military law, what have you, there would be it wouldn't be voluntary, let me put it that way. Mm.
Is it possible to say a little something at least about, if you do indeed go back to the early history of medicine, before we really understood well why it was people got sick, and particularly what the transmission mechanisms were for infectious disease, how physicians at the time and public officials at the time dealt with or tried to deal with those diseases?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and what we don't, you know, most people don't realize is that the idea that germs, tiny microscopic organisms, could cause these serious diseases that would kill a big human being, that's a concept that was laughable. If I were to present this to medical students in the 1840s, they would laugh me out of the room. And it wasn't really until the 1880s with people like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch and a number of other great bacteriologists and microbiologists figured out that for many diseases that are infectious in nature, there's a germ, and you can prove that this germ causes this disease reliably, and then they figured out how they spread from person to person. But if you go back to, say, Hippocrates, who, by the way, one of his greatest books was a book called Epidemics. And, in fact, that is the book where the term first do no harm comes from. Everyone misquotes the Hippocratic Oath. As, you know, that's where the first do no harm comes from, but it comes from epidemics. But at that time, they thought, well, we know it spreads from person to person, but we have no idea how, and maybe it's some pollution of the atmosphere. And in fact, the word infection comes from a Greek root, infectio, which means to dye, D-Y-E, to stain. And so there were concepts that somehow the atmosphere was being stained or polluted. This goes on, well, from centuries, concepts of miasma, foul air, of rotting organic waste, you know, sewage and such. And if you went to a city 200 years ago like London or New York, they smelled pretty bad. You know, they had rotting food, horse waste, human waste, and so on. So it was not that big of a leap to think that somehow these bad smells are causing poisons that we're somehow ingesting or breathing in or what have you. So it wasn't until the 1880s, 90s, and then the turn of the 19th to the 20th century that we had better information of the modern acceptance of how these infectious diseases are contracted and spread. But it's not surprising, too, that the idea of whether you believe in germs, you believe in miasma or whatever, that if you could somehow shut the gates to a city or a port to all newcomers, all boats, that that might help stem the tide of an epidemic. And to some extent, that probably did do something.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Howard Markle. He's a physician. He's also an historian of medicine. He's professor of the history of medicine and professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases at University of Michigan, and has written quite a lot on this subject about epidemics and public health. And his most recent book is When Germs Travel, Six Epidemics That Invaded America Since 1900 and the Fears They Unleashed. That was first published by Pantheon in May of last year, and this year in May came out in a paperback edition published by Vintage Random House. So if you'd like to read the book, I'm sure you can find it. He's also contributed to the New York Times and other publications, Harper's, The Atlantic, New Republic, Wall Street Journal, and other papers. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone else here to talk with in Charleston, line one. Hello.
Yes. Two questions. About a year or so ago, I watched C-SPAN. This man had written a book about the flu. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it was the 1918 flu.
Yes, it was. It was John Barry's book, The Great Influenza.
Yes, it was very good. And he mentioned that if maybe the city in the South, if you went outside without a mask on, you were in danger of being shot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the lines.
Well,
from that.
Yeah, there were, and I've actually been looking into. We're doing my center here at Michigan is doing some work for the government right now about what happened, what worked in 1918, and what did not. Face masks were very, very popular back then, and there were many mandatory laws. Whether or not people were shot or threatened with being shooting, I think that's hyperbole. I have not found
that. Well, that was his.
I understand that, but I've looked at the documents. I haven't seen anyone threatened with being shot. But there were some very strict laws in certain places. San Francisco, for example, had one of the harshest laws, and people were arrested or fined. And the types of masks they wore were basically 4 to 6 layers of gauze. Now, if you know what gauze is, it's pretty porous, and it probably didn't do all that much, although it might have done a little. If you're coughing and you have flu, it might have protected a little bit. But it probably didn't do all that much. And what is concerning is that it might have caused some harm because people often wore them incorrectly. They wore them dangling from their chins, or they took them off, or what have you. And so the idea of a face mask might give you some sense of protection that you might not otherwise have. In terms of, you know, hyperbole of people were shot. This is something that's very interesting to me because there's a lot of flu mythologies out there that what happened in 1918 you find in one newspaper account, but you can't reproduce anywhere else. And, you know, heaven forbid I write for newspapers, but sometimes newspapers don't get all the details exactly right. Having said that, it's a very interesting question now that we have mass these N95 masks that are very good in protecting the spread of infectious diseases. We are not, the CDC, meaning the government, is not recommending mandatory face masks for influenza. But it is something that you might want to voluntarily think about, you know, on your own. But you've got to learn how to use them correctly. It is a disease that is spread by coughing and sneezing.
Well, the Chinese, you know, and the Asian nations, you saw when
yes.
that last epidemic, or maybe the predecessor to what's going on now, that it was everywhere in the news.
Absolutely.
And, well, in my second question, kind of two-part.
And it's part of the tradition, by the way, a very cultural tradition in Asia
yes.
during flu epidemics to wear masks. The question is that mask porous? And are these respiratory droplets getting through? And even surgical masks that the you know the surgeons use in the OR are notorious for not being all that protective. But they are being worn, I agree.
Well, they leak, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. There's holes. We don't think about it, but there's tiny microscopic holes in any piece of fabric.
The other part of my two-part question, if you could address what I read some time ago, about the leper colonies
mm-hmm.
and how that was all addressed. And maybe I can't remember the exact book, but about shipping people who were not obviously stricken with leprosy, but were shipped in any case because they were nearby to lepers in ordinary
mm-hmm.
society.
Right.
And that, you know, if you give a little history of that,
sure.
And then the exploitation of the situation, which interests me most, you know, who profits from these epidemics? Nothing
yep.
happens in a vacuum.
Yep.
And as it progresses, and who makes the money, and
mm-hmm.
who profiteers by those things?
Yeah.
Well, I'll hang up and listen.
Well, those are wonderful questions. They're very astute questions. The first one, the leper colonies. There were two, and there's still one, I think, in Carville, Georgia, and there was one in Hawaii. Leprosy is caused by a bacillus called Hansen's bacillus, which is a cousin of syphilis. It's not a sexually transmitted disease. Leprosy is not, but it's in the same family of bacteria. It's probably not nearly as contagious as they once thought years ago. In fact, it's pretty tough to contract. But nevertheless, lepers who had the disease were essentially quarantined. They were isolated from others. And this is where that distinction we were talking earlier in the show, the difference between isolation, someone who is sick, versus quarantine, someone who is suspected of being sick or suspected of having contact with someone who is being sick, comes into play. And these were institutions that ran for many, many, many years. And in parts of the developing world, leprosy remains a problem, although there are some wonderful antibiotics that can be used to treat them if you can get those antibiotics to those people. Your second question is fascinating because you're right. I mean, nothing happens in a vacuum. That's the historian's craft, is what were the things that contributed to it. And while there are contours and shapes to epidemics, it's a different mix each time, depending on the germ, the country, the time period, on and on, the science, and on and on and on. One strong theme, though, is the economics. And you find time and again snake oil salesmen. You can find ads in every newspaper in the 1830s, 50s, 60s, 90s, 1900s, whatever, selling, you know, the cure for cholera, the cure for flu, whatever. There are a lot of people on the internet. I look it up, selling these N95 masks. You can, if you Google N95 masks, you'll find 20 or 30 distributors who will be happy to sell you all the masks you could ever want. And there are other people who have a vested interest. You know, scientists who are doing research on influenza are, I'm not suggesting they're ecstatic about the potential crisis, but their research revenue streams are much better than they were a few years ago. Companies that are making drugs, you know, Tamiflu, an antiviral that we think might work for avian flu. We think it might work for mice. We're not entirely sure about human beings. Well, if you're making Tamiflu, that's a good. This is a good time, and if you're making influenza vaccine, this is a good time for that. So you're right. There's a big business involved. There's a lot of money involved, and also when you order a quarantine, when you shut down an airport or a seaport, you lose a ton of money because there's a lot of goods and services going through those ports.
You know, that's actually a point that I was thinking about raising about the difficulty and the challenges that had been posed to people who work in the area of public health and those people who have commercial concerns. And certainly in port cities, we've seen it. I think we've seen it in New York. I think we've seen it around the time of this cholera epidemic that you write about. I think earlier in the 1800s in New York, they had a number of outbreaks of yellow fever.
Right.
And there were similar kinds of concerns there as well.
And we saw it with SARS. You know, when WHO didn't really quarantine Toronto, but they ordered a traveler's advisory. Well, there were thousands of conventions that were canceled that year, that 2 or 3 month period. A lot of restaurants didn't get the business, a lot of hotels and so on. So, yeah, it's always part of it. And people, the commercial interests always complain because their bottom line is just, you know, melting away. I'm mixing my metaphors. They're basically losing a ton of money. So it is something that needs to be thought about. And, you know, you could be wrong. You could call a quarantine and the disease might not ever get there, or something else could work out, such as what we saw with swine flu in 1976.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, I think I should introduce him again, is Dr. Howard Markle. He's on the faculty at the University of Michigan. He's a physician and historian of medicine and has written about this very subject, that is the history of epidemics and public health in the United States during the 20th century. And his most recent book is the one I mentioned a couple of times. It's titled When Germs Travel, Six Epidemics That Invaded America Since 1900 and the Fears They Unleashed. Questions welcome 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems that whenever we have a kind of concern like flu, for example, or SARS before, or other sorts of infectious diseases, that we start looking at the public health system as it exists here in the United States. And I think that people say it's not a new kind of observation that we've really, in starving public health of resources, we've made a serious mistake, and that in past history, we've appreciated much more. And maybe it was during the times when medicine didn't have the kind of technology that we have. But in the past, we appreciated just how important public health is as a way of spreading disease and trying to guarantee the health of the population. It seems to be something that in cycles we forget and then we are reminded of, and yet at the same time, people would say that we're being reminded of the importance of public health doesn't necessarily mean that we're putting any resources into the public health system.
Absolutely. You said it beautifully. The thing about public health is that when it's working at its best, it's silent. You don't have epidemics. You don't have crises. And so then the next year when you're making out the budget, you say, well, why do I have to have a $1 billion tuberculosis plan? There's no TB. Well, there will be if you don't keep it in check. Or AIDS, or malaria, or in this case, influenza. So we have to be thinking about these problems all the time. You know, we think about military defense all the time, whether we're in war or not, and we have to think of public health as a different form of defense as we live in a much smaller world than we ever did before. People travel all around the globe, and we're living in an era not only of emerging infectious diseases, avian flu, if it became a human problem, would be an emerging infectious disease. SARS was. AIDS was a newly emerging disease a few decades ago, as well as re-emerging infectious diseases, tuberculosis, malaria, old-fashioned cholera, old-fashioned diseases that are killing people in the developing world as we speak. 1,500 people died in the last hour that we've just been speaking of some infectious diseases. Most of those people died of malaria, TB, and AIDS. So this profound amnesia we have after a crisis, you know, SARS, well, what's that? Next year, flu, well, what's that? That's exactly the wrong response. We have to be thinking about these problems well in advance and working on them all the time. And it's an investment that is so valuable in terms of return, not only on protection of health, but also on, you know, productivity, the workforce, and so on. Because when you shut things down, well, look, SARS cost the world economy about $60 to $100 billion. WHO the other week suggested that if there was an avian flu scare, it would cost the world economy $800 billion. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, well, the cost of the public health mechanisms is far less, a fraction of that.
Back at the beginning of the program, I just made a quick reference to the fact that earlier in the fall, the president said and unveiled the government's plan to try to prepare for the potential of a pandemic of avian flu. We know just how dangerous and deadly that could be. Now, apparently, it's been figured out that the pandemic of 1918-1919 was also an avian flu.
And yeah, that people, was remarkable research in between those two points. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So people worry that again, as we've said, right now we have a virus that that's basically a bird virus, although we know that there are people that have gotten it from the birds. The big concern is if it mutates so that it can be easily passed from one person to another, then we would have a serious problem.
Yes.
So so the president said, well, here, what we're going to do, he's asking for money. He's asking money for research. There has been this discussion about should we stockpile drugs, although then there's also the issue that some people say, well, you can't really, this is not the kind of thing where you can really stockpile drugs until you know what it is you're trying to trying to fight. If you take a look at what it is that the government has proposed to do to try to prepare for the possibility of another flu pandemic, what can you say about that? Do you think that it's adequate? Are we taking the right kind of approach?
Well, I'm delighted that the president and the administration is looking at flu, which is more than what was going on 6 months ago. You know, in terms of, you know, when the President of the United States talks about something, that's a big deal. I should also remind your listeners is that this is still a work in progress. So what has been formulated and suggested is still being worked on by a whole cadre of experts, of dedicated public health professionals, both in the government and at universities and hospitals around the country. And the discussions are active, they're vociferous, they're heated, and they're concerned and in very good professional dialogues. I think of that $7.1 billion plan, which was simply a proposal, by the way, not an execution, it's a little bit too heavily weighted on antivirals that may or may not work and vaccines that we have for regular flu, but we don't yet really have. We're working on them for avian flu. In that proposed budget, only $150 million went to local and state public health agencies in the United States. I think that should be much higher, especially since the WHO just came out yesterday in a report saying that local communities will be instrumental. And that's what the history shows, too, is that local communities can play an important role, but they have to have the resources, the manpower, and so on to do that work. And the second issue is only about $250 million of that proposed $7.1 billion is to go around the world in terms of surveillance, health, public health mechanisms, and most importantly in my mind, looking at domestic poultry flocks and perhaps migratory flocks. That the latter will be a lot tougher because, you know, it's hard to get migratory birds. But we know that, for example, in Indonesia for the last 2 years, they have had a problem with avian flu in their domestic chicken population. In 1997, when Hong Kong discovered a similar problem, they killed all the birds within a five-mile radius. And that was important because it nipped it in the bud. The problem is in places like Indonesia or Africa, many people raise their own chickens. That's a major form of subsistence. That's how they live. And so that if you don't have something in place, you know, we're going to kill your chickens, but we're going to give you a dollar a bird, or we're going to give you food or something in replacement of that, people are going to hide their birds from the public health authorities. So I think those are some of the tactics I'd like to see taken as well. I can assure you they are being discussed. They're not being forgotten. And so non-pharmacologic interventions to both preventing the epidemic as well as containing its potential spread are on the discussion table and being pursued.
Mm. When people every year go down to where it is they get their health care and they line up to get their flu shots, that shot that they have gotten has been months in the development,
right?
That every year, people who develop these vaccines, they have the opportunity to look out, and they particularly look to the east, where it seems that the virus is come from. And they can look around and they can collect samples and they can try to figure out what the form of the virus takes that year, and it continues to mutate, and there are all kinds of forms. And so what they're doing is they're, in a sense, they're making a bet.
Yeah.
They're looking at all of the viruses that are out there. They're saying, well, we think here's a couple.
All the strains of the virus.
Right, yeah. All the strains. And they say, okay, well, here's the couple that we think we're going to try to protect people against. So they make their bet. They produce the virus. It takes a couple of months to produce the virus. Then it's distributed, and people get it. So here the lead, we're talking about pretty significant lead time between identifying the strain of the virus we want to protect people against and then being able to have something to shoot in, you know, to give people. So the question is, given the fact that that takes time, what's the likelihood that if there is indeed the virus mutates to this point we've talked about, that we will be able to identify it in with enough lead time so that we can produce a vaccine so that we'll actually have something to offer to people?
Well, it's pretty bleak. It is a very good educated guess by these experts who follow the strains and what's most prevalent, and they're right many, many more times than they're wrong, but there is room for error in that, particularly if it mutates or reassorts or God knows what. The second thing that everyone has to remember is that a vaccine is, you're growing it. It's a product that you're growing, and so it takes 6 to 9 months to grow it in chicken eggs, and that... We are, the scientists who will work on vaccines have done some remarkable things to shorten. First, it was a 9-month process. Now it's been a 6-month process. And I'm fairly confident as time goes on that production period will be shrunk even further, but probably not shorter than 3 months of time. So those kind of rate limiting steps do prevent you from having perfect vaccination coverage, as you do for more stable infectious diseases like polio. There's 3 strains, and it pretty much stays the same for year to year, smallpox, diphtheria, what have you. Influenza is really quite a crafty virus. For avian flu, there is some work, and there were reports a few weeks back of an experimental avian flu vaccine, but that's still in the testing and on the drawing board kind of, not drawing board, it's, you know, it's being worked on stage, so it's not ready to be distributed to, you know, millions and millions of people around the world yet. But we're hopeful that that will happen. We're hopeful that time is on our side. I don't believe anyone predicts an avian flu, human-to-human transmission pandemic will happen this year, but nobody knows. That's the billion-dollar question. Nobody knows. No one can predict the future. So hopefully time will be on our side and we can work out some of these kinks. But because the flu virus itself changes so rapidly, you're never going to have 100% prediction rate.
We were talking a little bit earlier about the reality of infectious disease, and that I suppose this might be something of an oversimplification, but I think that it's substantially correct to say something like viruses don't care who you are. They will go after you, assuming that the conditions are right. It doesn't matter who you are; they'll go after you.
Right.
But that we still in as much as we on one level recognize that, I think that as we think, and I'm not talking about sort of science. I guess I'm talking about the way basically people think that we still have some association between who you are and whether you get sick, and that we have somewhere in the back of our minds, we have this idea that if you get sick, it's probably your fault.
Right.
And that's a seriously mistaken way of thinking, because that gets in the way of actually trying to deal with the spread and treatment of the disease. But that we can't quite seem to get away from that idea somehow.
Yeah. Well, and it's biblical, you know, the idea of divine providence. Somehow you were struck down with a plague. I mean, remember the 10 plagues of Egypt? Many of them were bad diseases. And that it's somehow a divine retribution for something that you may have done, you know, recently or a long time ago. And we're slowly but surely getting away from that, but it rears its ugly head at the worst possible moments. To be sure, some infectious diseases favor the poor. You know, if you don't have a roof over your head, you're not eating well, and so on. But some infectious diseases favor the rich. For example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt got polio as an adult because he had never been exposed to it as a child because he lived in a very ritzy neighborhood that had its own water supply and so on. So the bottom line is, yeah, I mean, it's simplistic. It's not completely true, but, you know, germs are quite, they're the most democratic of all organisms I've ever studied, and they're really just looking for a warm body to infect. And, you know, it's bad enough having a terrible contagious disease without somebody judging you for it. And I've been a doctor a long time. I've never met anyone who deserved these diseases. And I have thousands of colleagues who would back me up on this. It really, it's a red herring. What we have to do is think about diseases as things that happen. And I'm always reminded of my first day of medical school. A lawyer was talking to us about medical jurisprudence, and he said, you know what, you guys don't get to judge your patients, you get to treat them. If you want to judge people, go across the campus to the law school. And I think that's something we all have to think about when it comes to disease and human beings. It's not something about judgment or what you did wrong. If you meet the wrong organism at the wrong time, you're going to get one of these diseases.
Well, there we will have to leave it. We won't say, Dr. Markle, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our guest, Dr. Howard Markle, he's a physician. He's also a historian of medicine. He's on the faculty at the University of Michigan. His most recent book is When Germs Travel, Six Epidemics That Invaded America Since 1900 and the Fears They Unleashed. It was published in paperback this spring in May by Vintage Books Random House. Focus 580, this program is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Beginning in the 1930s, the U.S. government commissioned photographers to make a record of the impact of the Depression. We're probably most familiar with the images that speak to the hardships of that time. For example, Dorothea Lange's photograph Migrant Mother comes to mind. But other photographs speak to the spirit and also to the strength of the nation. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn, the host, will be talking about those other kinds of photographs with Colleen McDaniel. She is the author of a recent book entitled Picturing Faith, Photography and the Great Depression. The book has just recently been published. She's professor of history and also religious studies at the University of Utah. And she will be talking with Celeste in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Today, the program, with its usual mix of news and sports and other things, gets underway at noon. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking with Christopher Halliwell, who's written a lot about the culture and the environment of the Gulf Coast here in the United States. We'll talk about his book, Holding Back the Sea, The Struggle on the Gulf Coast to Save America. First, though, we'll break for news, an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at LincolnLandAgriEnergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the Chicago Board of Trade, where corn futures were weak early today amid disappointing export sales data. USDA reported this morning corn sales of 24.1 million bushels. The trade was looking for numbers from 31.5 to 39.4. Also bearish, another round of heavy deliveries against the December contract. Meanwhile, over in the wheat pit, we're seeing a mixed results, light commercial selling there, pressuring both the